Okay, so we're into the final week of the election, or just a couple of days away from the election being wrapped up on April 28th. So obviously there's been a couple of things that have changed over the weekend. We had a bit of a longer break. The nation sort of paused for Easter for a couple of days, and just getting back into it this morning. What's been your take on how things have been developing so far, Levi?
Yeah, well, like you said, it's been a quick election. I mean, I guess every time it feels like that. But you just start driving around a little bit more, you see more signs going up. Some of the candidates who are kind of behind the eight ball finally getting their presence out. So I can notice some of that going on over the weekend, or actually including today. All the major parties released, basically all the parties released their full platforms. So as someone who kind of really likes to see what parties are promising and it's like to read through policy platforms, I found that quite exciting. Even though one of the political parties, the NDP, decided like we're not actually going to release a whole standalone platform. We'll throw up a couple ideas on our website and call it good there. So it's interesting when a party decides that they don't need to actually have a comprehensive platform that covers all sorts of different issues. But all the other parties
only
have something out there.
Being this close to the election day for them to start putting out the party platforms now, I don't know whether they just weren't prepared or if it's something where they didn't necessarily want the crucial issues of the what their party platforms are being debated publicly. Any sense of that, or is it just they needed time to put it together?
I think this is just like happening more and more. Like we had a provincial election here in British Columbia 6 months ago, and I think it was also basically not until a week before voting day the parties actually released their platforms. Which in my mind is a little odd. I was trying to see if I could find numbers of Canadians who went to go vote in the advance polls. Elections Canada didn't release that, but apparently there were 2 million Canadians that voted on Friday alone, which means you're getting like maybe 20% of all people who actually go cast a ballot have already done so without even having seen your full platform. So I feel like if I'm a political party, I would want that out sooner before people cast their vote rather than later. But obviously they have different priorities there. And at the end of the day, I'm guessing that most people are already voting, already knowing roughly where parties are going to stand on this and that issue and voting accordingly. Where I think these platforms are particularly helpful is for us as ARPA Canada staff or as constituents to say, hey, you promised this in an election and here's your party platform that proved what you promised on this issue or that issue, and you can help hold their feet to the fire. So it's almost in many ways something more beneficial for afterwards.
Any sense based on that voter turnout over the weekend, the advance polling, whether that's going to indicate there's more interest, like we'll have a better voter turnout this time than last time? Or because I know in the provincial election in Ontario, the voter turnout was quite poor and seems year over year to be getting worse. But is this indicative that people care more in this election, or is it more that people are taking advantage of the advance polling just because it's more convenient, especially over a long weekend? Or is it just
I don't have any data on my fingertips, but from as far or as I can recall, it seems like there is more and more of a trend for people just to vote early rather than on election day. Mm-hmm. Particularly when election day is on a Monday, a work Monday, it seems a lot easier for people to say, hey, I was off Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Monday even, let's go cast my ballot there. So that makes a kind of a lot of sense why people would cast a ballot then as opposed to waiting until next Monday.
So the other interesting thing that's been developing is the slight change, and I say this somewhat hesitantly, but slight change in the polling numbers for the Liberals, looking at the numbers now from this week versus last week. So now the seat projection, again, 172 seats for the majority, they're at 184. So this is slightly down, about 10 down from last week, I think, 10 seats, and the Conservatives are slightly up. Looking at this, I don't know if you'll be able to see this on camera, but there's a slight, ever so slight, kind of moving towards the middle when it comes to the odds of election outcome chart. Any ideas on whether that will continue? What do you think?
I mean, I think you mentioned on this this podcast before, maybe it was the Ontario election podcast, that we all like to have some sort of like little guesses or bets about what the outcomes are going to be. And already a few weeks ago, when the polling numbers were showing that Liberals were going to probably win a majority government. I said, I think it's going to tighten up a little bit before election day. So I think it's going to continue to tighten up a little bit more. But whether that is going to actually change the outcome of the election, I don't really know. But based on everything we can see right now, I mean, certain parties dominate in certain parts of the country. Like, of course, the Conservatives do really well in Alberta and the Prairies, and the Liberals do really well in Atlantic Canada right now. But unfortunately, that's not where most of the votes are. Like, I think close to half the seats in the country are in Ontario and in Quebec. And if the federal Liberals are leading by, I think it's like 8 points in Ontario and like almost tw like 15 points, maybe 20 points in Quebec, and they scoop up like at least two-thirds the seats in those two provinces, there's really nothing any other party can do to try to stop them from forming government. So if there's going to be any change, there has to be some change in those two provinces. And I hate saying that as a West Coaster and always saying, hey, it's Quebec and Ontario that matter. So.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it see I think the reality is even if the Conservatives get a significant chunk of the overall vote percentage, the reality is that their voter base is so concentrated in certain areas, especially in Saskatchewan and Alberta, that the distribution doesn't really help them. Because if you're winning in a riding, it doesn't matter whether you win by 90% or by 51%, you're still winning, and those extra votes don't really help you anywhere else in the country. So that unfortunately means, like you say, the balance of power is often decided by the eastern provinces to some degree. Turning then to the policy position, so obviously there was also the debate that took place, the English and French language debates. Was there anything interesting that developed there on our issues of focus? Do you know?
On the debates, I didn't really catch anything. I was trying to watch while my father-in-law was in town and trying to have conversation with me, and I was also trying to wrangle two of my two daughters as well. So I didn't pay quite as close attention as I was hoping to, but I didn't catch really any conversation in the debates on any of the issues that we focus on. And that's kind of typical. Oftentimes, they're focused on like bigger or macro issues like the economy or foreign relations or something like that anyways. So it's not necessarily surprising, but I'd probably say overall I was the debates exceeded my expectations. That's because I have pretty low expectations for the way that these debates are usually held and how much information gets across and how civil they are. But in this case, it exceeded my expectations, even if it necessarily wasn't that helpful or that much new information was brought out. But at the very least, it's one of the few times where I actually sit down and watch the leaders interact and speak for any length of time rather than a sound clip or just reading about what they do in the news. So I think even there, it's helpful to see, okay, this is the temperament, this is the personality, this is the
Are they
personal
interacting with each
charisma.
other? Yeah.
Yeah, or are they just talking over each other and bashing each other? And so for the most part, I thought they did actually pretty well of not doing those two things, except for the NDP leader, Jagmeet Singh, seemed to be the most aggressive in trying to
Yeah.
interject and butt in.
He has the most to lose in some ways. I mean, some of the bump the Liberals have been having be is because, unfortunately, it seems he can't seem to find his traction this election. So he had an opportunity there, I think, or that's at least what he saw as an opportunity to sort of try to derail one of the other two. But I'm not sure it was successful enough to make a big enough swing for his party.
Yeah.
Taking a
Yeah.
look then at the specific issue of gender, which is our issue of focus for this week for the campaign, for the election. Again, we have our election guide on the website, which now we'll have to update it. I mentioned this last time. This is a printable document. There's also, as Levi pointed out, you need a magnifying glass potentially to read all the wording on there. But we do have it also on the website in digital version. So if you want to zoom in, you can zoom in as far as you want on that. So maybe take us through this issue, Levi. Obviously, a little over a year ago, we launched the Let Kids Be campaign, which was one of the first of its kind in Canada, focusing specifically on the gender issue and specifically, more specifically, on medical transitions for minors. So maybe take us through that and some of the key developments that have happened since then.
Yeah, well, the issue of gender, at least as we covered as Upper Canada, is kind of multifaceted, so it's not just a single thing. So, but as we're focusing on, we really want to focus on what you mentioned, the medical transitions for minors and Canada's conversion therapy law. But maybe I'll start with the medical transitions for minors. Because we know that's something that's a growing and huge concern in this country. And coming into the election, we were hopeful because one conservative government out in Alberta had introduced a suite of policies that basically banned medical transition for minors for under 16 for sure, and for all forms of surgery, medical gender surgery for people under 18. So we saw one good policy at the provincial level. You're hoping that would carry over to other levels of governments. And at the last federal conservative policy convention, the grassroots of the federal conservatives, they also affirmed that their party would stand against medical transitions for minors. And the leader, Pierre Poilievre, said that he would also, he said in his personal comments, he also said that he wanted to stand against it. So
And that was a pretty
we.
significant majority, too, right, of the vote at that time. Because
Yeah,
was it a policy? It was a policy amendment or recommendation or whatever at the at their convention, correct?
I was there, and there was a handful of what we might call socially conservative policies up for debate and voting on. And I thought to myself, it'll be really interesting to see how all of these policies pass. Are they going to get defeated? Are they going to pass by just a slim majority? And I think that one on trying to ban medical transition for minors that went into the Conservative Party handbook, I think it passed by like, it was at least 75%. Like it was in the 70s or
Yeah,
80s. And I was quite surprised when it actually happened and it got that high.
it's interesting to see that there's that movement, at least at the grassroots level for the, of the party, to see change like that happen. Do you think that's what, is it something related to that, or is it maybe connected to some of the changes that Alberta, maybe the success the Alberta government has had in its transgender policies or focusing on this issue that Pierre decided to speak on this issue?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he it seems that everything he does, he tries to have some sort of polling or some sort of like, I'm only going to talk about this if I know there's a significant portion of Canadians that are interested in talking about this and opposed to it. And there is quite a bit of opposition among Canadians that medical transition for minors is something that we need to restrict a little bit more. And we're seeing that south of the border, when the United States, when the federal government said that we're going to not allow or not support financially or in any other way medical transitions for minors, or the United Kingdom saying nope, there's not going to be any puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones or surgeries for minors either, or at least for people under 16. So there are other countries around the world that are starting to take steps there in other provinces here. And so I think do think that gave Pierre Poilievre a little bit of confidence to speak on it personally, and what he would do as a federal leader as well. But then also getting into the election, just a couple weeks ago, Mark Carney was asked by a reporter about what he would do, what he thought of Canada's or Alberta's laws on medical transition for minors and preventing it. And he basically said that, oh, I think healthcare is a right in Canada, and lumping medical transition in there. And he seemed to imply that he would not restrict the practice whatsoever. He didn't like what Alberta was doing. And actually, one of his own children, one of his daughters, actually went to the gender identity services clinic at Tavistock in the United Kingdom. For what I could find, she didn't actually receive any medical transitioning there. She just had some counseling and some therapy there. And what she thinks about medical transitioning herself is kind of her personal thoughts. But I can't help but think like what her daughter went through, her thoughts on that, her advocacy on it can't help but influence her dad's perspective about whether this should be allowed or shouldn't be allowed in Canada.
And the Tavistock Clinic is sort of the infamous one in the United Kingdom that was shut down by the government there. When was that? At least several months ago. And is sort of part and parcel or tied in with the Cass report that took place there as well, right? That gave made some recommendations, a government study that recommended changes to their government gender policy, right?
And now those were changes in the shutdown that wasn't really partisan. Like it was started by the conservatives of not maybe not surprisingly, started by the Conservatives in the UK. But when there was a Labour government elected there, the Labour government continued to keep Tavistock mostly shut down, and was I oversaw the latest kind of health guidelines that medical transitioning shouldn't be available for young minors. And so on that side of the pond, it's a multi-partisan issue that medical transitioning for minors is by and large not a good thing, but it's a lot more polarized and more partisan here in Canada, unfortunately.
Do you have any idea why that might be? And I wonder if I know this is obviously a more recent development in terms of the White House executive orders on this front, but is there any sense that maybe what happened is that a good thing? Obviously, there was some good direction in terms of the momentum on this file in Canada, even as well as in the United States, around the world, really, to start asking questions and say, okay, the common sort of knowledge on this, there's something wrong with it, or it's not taking into full account the impact on minors. And I think what the White House did, obviously, when that was back in January, shortly thereafter, the government there put out executive orders specifically changing certain gender policies in the government. But I wondered a little bit, and maybe this is just an opinion question, but whether that might have impacted Canada's trajectory on that, where suddenly those who had concerns or raised concerns about the issue of medical transition for minors now were sort of ideologically associated with the Trump administration somehow, and if has that caused any slowdown of progress on this issue in Canada?
Yeah, as I was thinking through the questions you're asking, I think you highlight the ideology piece on the head, because I think in Canada, maybe more than the United Kingdom, more than the United States, our political parties are a little more ideological as opposed to like practical, like what are small things we can change. I mean, we can see this we've said this for a long time on the We Need a Law campaign on the issue of abortion. Like, there's lots of Canadians that want some restrictions or some on when it on comes things like it comes like medical, or sorry, medical transitions for minors, sex selective abortion, or other tweaks about Canada's abortion law. There seems to be some general support there, but the various political parties are ideological about it. It's like, we're not even going to go down that route. We're just going to talk about women's right to choose, or not introducing any law whatsoever to tackle abortion. Or same with medical assistance in dying. When Pierre Poilievre was asked what his position there, he's like, we're not going to expand the law, but we're going to keep it as is and recognize the right of Canadians to determine their own future and their own autonomy there. Like, it's a very much of a ideological language as opposed to like, okay, what's the specific problem? What are ways that we can fix it? And ways that the federal government can respond. And I think it's the same thing here, is even though there might be, we think, of course, there are real concerns with gender ideology, medical transitioning, the political parties aren't bold enough to just deviate from an ideological line, yes, this is good, no, this is bad, to get into the nuances on it and say, there are really things that we need to take a look at. And it might not be as easy as black and white, this is all good or this is all bad, but they refuse to have those nuanced conversations, just stick with the ideological talking points on issues like this. And unfortunately, it is really frustrating in a federal election when we should be talking about the problems that face Canada and how to solve them.
Yeah, and it's right away, you're painted in a certain corner, right? And that is unfortunate. So then maybe shifting to the other point that you were hoping to make in relation to the conversion therapy legislation that Canada has brought into effect a couple of years ago. So this is obviously a controversial thing for a variety of reasons, but maybe you can explain first, before we get into where we hope that goes, explain a little bit more why we had concerns about that legislation. Because I think to the average Canadian, the idea of a government putting the brakes on conversion therapy, so to speak, like trying to change someone's gender, change someone's sexuality, those kinds of things. In some ways, there's echoes of the same points we were just making about gender identity in the conversion therapy question. So what's the difference, and how do we sort of defend our opposition to this conversion therapy legislation?
Yeah, well, one of the biggest things is just like the very broad definition of conversion therapy. And even as I talk about this more, we're working on updating the conversion therapy policy report to reflect where Canada is right now. And the more I hear that term conversion therapy, the more I'm like, I don't really like the term, because in reality, in a Christian and a biblical understanding of what a human being is, if you are counseling someone to embrace the gender that God has given you, to use your body sexually the way that God has designed it to, those are the ways that God has created, and that's who you truly should are and how you truly should be acting. And so it's not trying to convert someone from being gay or transgender to being cisgender or straight or heterosexual. It's not a conversion practice that's there. It's what we as Christians would say is like, we're trying to understand who God created you to be. And focus on that. So in my perspective, is there's no conversion happening there. We're trying to point to people back who they truly are, how God created them to be. Unfortunately, in our country today, that's not how it's viewed. Your identity can be chosen based on how you feel about your gender, about how you feel about your sexual attraction and things like that. And what you feel determines who you are. And if that's where we understand identity in Canada, then calling something conversion therapy does make a little bit more sense. You are trying to change someone's feelings or their behavior or their identity. And so one of the big problems with Canada's conversion therapy law is just how broad that definition is. It includes any practice, any treatment, any service that tries to change someone's sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression, even if it's something as small as counseling someone not to act on their same-sex attraction or not to wear opposite-sex clothing. Those are attempts to try to change someone's behavior. And under Canada's conversion therapy law, those are criminalized and those are banned. So that's why the conversion therapy legislation, in our eyes, was so concerning and so draconian.
So just to clarify maybe what you're saying there in terms of the philosophical difference, there's because in some sense that's the issue, is there's a worldview difference in which we're trying to argue that from a biblical perspective that the physical body matters, right? And I know there's been some well-written Christian books out there that try to make that exact point, right? The Christian anthropology, the anthropology of the body, the understanding of what the body is. Where I think from a transgender perspective or gender sort of asking some of these questions, they put more value on who you are inside. And it's almost a Gnostic idea, this idea that somehow your body is less important than sort of whether it's your spirit or your soul or some internal essence of yourself, that that's who you truly are, and that's more important. And I think what we say as Christians and what we're identifying is the fact that your body and your soul matter. Who you are, if you want to call it that, inside, and who you are on the outside, those things are intricately created together. And so trying to help an individual who's struggling with these things, trying to help someone from a Christian perspective means helping them integrate those things rather than separating them. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's a fair assessment, absolutely. And even as Christians, like we just celebrate Good Friday and Easter, which is the death and resurrection of our Lord. And so maybe death and resurrection are on people's minds, or at least on my mind a little bit. But like in the Christian understanding, death is the separation of body and soul, at least for a time, something that fundamentally God created to be joined together. And so when you try to separate those two things or make them at conflict, that is fundamentally not how God created us to flourish. And that's fundamentally what the gender ideology posits, is that your soul, your gender, your spirit, your inner self is somehow different and can be in conflict with the physical body that God has given you.
So in terms of where we're hoping to go, what I mean, obviously the federal parties, at least at this point, haven't said, I don't think they've said anything specific to this. I don't know that the Conservatives have indicated whether they'd do anything on this front. Some of the other parties have. Maybe you can touch on that for a moment, like in terms of the Christian Heritage Party, People's Party, et cetera. There's been maybe a little bit more commentary there.
So, I mean, we'll take a step back. The Canada's Conversion Therapy Law, Bill C-4, it passed in the House of Commons 3.5 years ago now, December 2021. So do the math. And then it was a unanimous vote. So basically all the MPs that were present in the House of Commons, whether they Liberal, Green, NDP, Bloc, Conservative, they all voted in favor of that conversion therapy ban. So to start, there has to strike against the members of all those political parties with representation in the House.
Well, it was actually acclaimed, right? Like there wasn't even a vote, really. It was just they almost put it as a statement and waiting for someone to stand, and nobody stood. And so it passed unanimously as a result.
No one was willing to stand up against it. So that was a bad starting place for all of the political parties. And most of the political parties recently haven't reiterated whether they would change or support or do anything there. Like the Conservatives, the Liberals, the NDP, all three of those parties, as far as I have seen, have been quiet on that bill. The Green Party, who released their platform earlier this week, They did make a promise actually in there, and they promised to strengthen the enforcement of the conversion therapy ban. So not only is the law not enough in their eyes, they need to make it stronger and enforce it even more, which is certainly concerning. But then on the other side of the political spectrum, parties like the Christian Heritage Party and the People's Party, they both have said very vocally and for a long time, to their credit as well, that cannabis conversion therapy ban is far too broad, far too wide-ranging, if it needs to be repealed entirely, or at least changed, at least amended. And so where we would like to see as ARPA Canada, this kind of in a similar vein, is if that law can be entirely repealed, that would be a good thing. But at the very least, it needs to be amended so that the definition of conversion therapy, it's only it includes things that are like coercive forms of therapy, like non-voluntary forms of therapy, or trying to, or at least exempts kind of the low-hanging fruit or little things that no common sense Canadian should think that should be illegal, like trying to convince someone not to wear clothes of the opposite gender or not to act on their same-sex desires. So those are very small things on behavior that, at the very, very least, should definitely not be captured by Canada's conversion therapy law.
All right. Well, I think we've more or less touched on all the issues we were hoping to touch on. Is there anything else you wanted to share with our supporters in these last few days before we go to the polls on this particular issue? Or anything, really?
Well, careful of the open door that you give me, Colin. I
We've
might
only got a
just
couple
go
minutes
running
left,
through
so
it.
yeah.
I think the only thing I'll draw to wrap up is a question that was posed by reporters to the two major party leaders at different times and their answers to it. So, well, this again, this stems from what happened in the United States, where the Trump administration said that there are only two genders, there are only two sexes. And some reporters followed up with that and asked Pierre Poilievre, how many genders do you think there are? And Pierre Poilievre answered, kind of a little bit of a ton of tongue in cheek. It's like, I'm only aware of two genders. If you want to suggest more, I'm willing to consider them. But at least there's kind of firmly stating that I think there are only two, maybe being a little more flippant on it than he should have. But good to see that he drew that line in the sand. And then just a couple of days ago, I think it was actually right after one of the federal leaders debates, a reporter asked the same question of Mark Carney, the Liberal leader. He said, how many genders are there? And Carney, he paused for a second, thought for a second, and he just gave a really brief statement. And he said, in terms of sex, there are two. So even if he wasn't quite willing to commit to there be only two genders and get rid of all the transgender or non-binary or genderqueer, all those other categories of genderhood, at least he's willing to say there are only two biological sexes. There are only male and female. Now, what we hope is that he and many other Canadians would take the next step and think that there are only two sexes means that there are only two genders built on top of that. But it was encouraging even there for him to recognize that there are only two sexes, and
It's
Poilievre
almost
to
like
go
in
a
a
little
moment
further.
there, his talking points, the party platform talking points, just dropped out of his head, and he's like, "Okay, how do I answer this question logically and sensibly?" And a bit of
Yeah.
truth maybe came through, but.
Precisely. Well, and that's, I mean, a very, very side comment, but like the reporter that asked him was from, I think, the organization True North, which is not a mainstream media publication by any means. Some of those smaller independent news organizations were allowed to come to the debates and ask questions of the candidates. And when you let a more diverse set of media journalists attend and ask questions, you're going to get different answers and different questions that are really important. So I'm glad we could hear a little clarity, a little bit more of what they both leaders think on both of those questions.
All right, Levi. Well, thanks very much for the conversation. Again, 1 week till election, so we'll encourage all of you who are listening to make sure you get out and take the opportunity to cast your vote, and consider these issues. Consider the Federal Election Guide, like we say on the website. You can take a look at that if you're interested to delve further into that and make your choice based on what's there. So, thanks very much, Levi.
Yep, thank you, Colin.